Let's look a little bit at the chronology, which is you've got on page 87, but I'm going to comment it, which goes back a little way. You have in the 17th century already a certain number of books. Now, of course, it's much easier. Remember the difference between a book and a movement. It's much easier to write a book than to start a movement. No? You just write a book, yeah, and then it's finished. If you start a movement, sometimes it doesn't work. And 1792 is the somebody's going to talk about it probably next week. Is the date of the publication by Mary Wollstonecraft of A Vindication of the Rights of Women, an important book there. It's not an accident that it's in 1792. This is the most radical phase of the French Revolution. Yeah, and so that's one of the effects there. In 1803, I have marked here that the Methodist Conference, just one moment, the Methodist Conference, the Church of the Methodists, refuses to allow women to preach. Sorry, what was the question? Wollstonecraft. It's written on page 87 of your thingy. You need it. Okay. Yeah, I'm just going through to note the importance of these. So, interesting, a conference of Methodists refuses to allow women to preach. Now, this is interesting because, of course, this means that some women wanted to. Yeah. A conference will not decide to ban women if there are no women wanting to. Yeah? So there must have been some sort of controversy. Yeah? There must have been a demand. You don't ban people from doing things they never asked to do. Yeah, and so there must have been some kind of demand. And a series of campaigns in the 1820s, very small campaigns by small committees, led to, in 1823, the philosopher John Stuart Mill was imprisoned because he gave out information about birth control, about contraception. Yeah. And so that was very shocking at the time, very irreligious. And it shows he was determined and so on. But it would also show something which becomes typical for the women's rights movement. In general, the women's rights movements are, before 1900, are movements of minorities. That is that they are committees of a few hundred, sometimes a few thousand, but they are absolutely not mass movements like Chartism, etc. Now, there are reasons for this. The first reason is that most women's lives are more involved in surviving with their families than in wanting the right to vote. It's difficult to mobilize the ordinary women for demanding the right to vote. Secondly, a large number of women consider that if there was one vote in the family, this would be enough. Remember, at this time, most people do not vote, cannot vote, and a large section of working-class women consider that the problem is that nobody in their family can vote, and this idea of the family vote is quite influential at the time. Okay, I'm not going to read all of this, but a couple of key decisions in the 1840s. One in 1840, where a judge officially supports the right of a man to beat his wife in moderation. To beat his wife in moderation. That's a very, very famous tribunal case where the judge declares that as long as you beat your wife in moderation, that's okay. That's a natural right. Again, it's something which we which is quite shocking today. Some of the laws in the 1840s about factories include a particular condition applying to women. For example, the 1842 Mines Act means that women are not allowed to work underground. These were controversial acts, but in general were considered by men and women in the mining towns as a step forward. The idea was that women would be able to better look after the children. They were not seen as a restriction of women's rights, but as a protection of the working class family. Now, this is a controversy which continues to today. You're too young to remember, but about 8 years ago in France, they changed the law. The law was that women could not work nights in factories. And they changed the law to say that women can work nights in factories. And there was a big debate because some people were saying, well, you know, women should have the same rights. And other people were saying, no, we should stop factory work at nights for everybody, men and women. So there's that kind of argument going on, which is, again, another of these unsolved debates for the moment. In the late 1840s, then the first colleges for women teachers, 1849, the first college for women, and all that will continue. I will come back to all that. And a certain number of campaigns for the right of women to own property. I will come back to that again. Okay, I'm going to leave the chronology and come back to it later. I'm going to go to the actual people who defended women's rights and how they did. There was a certain tradition. Daniel Defoe, the famous author of Robinson Crusoe, he was very interested in women's rights. Also Henry Fielding, the great writer. And of course Mary Wollstonecraft, the Vindication of the Rights of Women, was a reference to the Declaration of the Rights of Man from the French Revolution. Yes, it was let's go further. And Mary Wollstonecraft, it's interesting, she defended the idea of having the same schools for boys and girls. Very radical idea at the time, the same schools for boys and girls. Interesting position of Wollstonecraft. Wollstonecraft accepts that women are inferior, but she says the reason women are inferior is because of their lack of education. And so she contradicts the idea of natural inferiority. Notice that at the time, most people who did not want things to change said women were naturally inferior. Today, people who don't want things to change say, you know, men and women are naturally different. But that's a later argument. At the time, it was not a problem. Inferior, of course. Inferior, yeah? Okay. An interesting argument of Mary Wollstonecraft, it's important not to see the 19th century writers through the eyes of modern feminists, because it's not the same approach. It's rather different. And for example, Mary Wollstonecraft argues that men will benefit if women have more rights, because women will make more interesting and educated partners for men. Okay, I'll leave you to think about that one. So Wollstonecraft, very, very radical, huh? Wollstonecraft criticized the society that encouraged women to be, and I quote, docile and attentive to their looks to the exclusion of all else. So this was Wollstonecraft's criticism of society. He says, in this society, women only think about how they look, and they never think about anything else. No comment. No comment there. Okay, right. And very, very hard words. Wollstonecraft says, what is marriage? Marriage is legal prostitution. Okay, so very, 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 very hard words there for, again, no comment here. I'm married. And she said, God, you find this amusing. Women may be convenient slaves, but slavery will have its constant effect, degrading the master and the dependent. And so it's degrading, it's a dégradant pour les deux. This is the opinion of Wollstonecraft. Very, very controversial, of course. They were attacked very ferociously by other writers. Wollstonecraft was described as a hyena in petticoats. What is a petticoat? C'est comme un porte-avant en dessous du... C'est un sous-jupe? Jupon, merci, thank you. My vocabulary of 19th century women's clothes is very little. Yeah, jupon, donc un lion, une hyène qui porte des jupons. Ok, gentil, hein. Ça fait un moment qu'on vous a pas traité de ça, non? Ok, right, so very, very radical. Not least because Wollstonecraft said, well, what do we need? We need to get rid of the monarchy, and we need to get rid of the church and the army. So you can understand that people were not happy with her. And even some of the radicals were rather shocked. Jeremy Bentham and John Cartwright. We mentioned John Cartwright, one of the first people who fought for more votes for men. He was against votes for women, for example. However, much later on, some men defended women's rights. John Stuart Mill, probably the most notable one. As I said, he was imprisoned for distributing information about contraception. And in 1867, on the case of the Second Reform Act, he proposed an amendment to include women. Yeah, so John Stuart Mill proposed an amendment. So say, oh yes, and I agree with this Reform Act, but we don't want just men, we want men and women. Now, of course it was not successful, but, and he knew it wouldn't be successful, but that's it's a political act to bring up the level of consciousness. And in 1869, he wrote his book, John Stuart Mill. This is the guy, John Stuart Mill. He's famous for something completely different. He's famous for philosophy, really. But he wrote in 1869 his book, The Subjection of Women. Okay, so you can see by the title, yeah, that it's a very, very, very radical book, yeah. La sujettissima, je crois. I'm not sure about that. Of women. Very shocking at the time. Most people said, well, no, women have the best position. Women don't join the army, they don't go to war. Huh? They don't work underground in the mines anymore. What is this objection? We don't understand it. Just to go back very briefly to Wollstonecraft, when she says that women are docile and attentive to their looks to the exclusion of all else, you do notice where she comes from. That is to say that this is not something that you could say about women workers in the textile factories. It wasn't possible. So she was talking, not deliberately, but accidentally, she was really talking about middle-class women. And very often, a whole period of the women's movement will be restricted to the women who have the time and money to join the campaign, and also who have husbands who accept. Yeah, because it, at this time it's almost impossible to be involved in politics if your husband doesn't agree. Even today it's not easy, but at the time it was really, really almost impossible. Now, I'm going to move on to the actual movements in themselves, the different campaigns and things like that. But these are not, of course, the first time that women are involved in politics. There have always been women involved in the mass struggles, but they didn't ask for anything specific for women. For example, in Peterloo, the big demonstration in 1819, where there were people killed, some of the people killed were women. And so it's not the case that these are the first ones. We saw already how women were involved in the anti-slavery movement, and how one of the most influential pamphlets, what was it called? Immediate, Not Gradual Abolition. Was written by a woman leader whose name I've forgotten, but I think it was Elizabeth somebody. So why was it that for the first time in the 1840s, the 1850s, there was really a women's movement for the first time in history? Fundamentally, well, I asked the question, I also have the answer, it's written here. There are two fundamental reasons. First of all, the fact that people live in towns and can read and write make things possible, which is not possible before. So the fact that people live in towns and also can read and write. But secondly, the religious tradition is not so strong. The religious tradition with a very strict role for women is not so strong. Of course, religious tradition will decline very, very slowly for 100 years or so. Yes? Yeah, religious tradition. Religious? Yeah, in the towns, yeah. The religious tradition is stronger in the village. Yeah, and not so strong. I don't mean it's weak, it's just less strong. Yeah, it's just less strong. There's a weakening of religious tradition. That's an interesting question. In fact, in the villages, it's almost impossible to know. Because there's much less writing and so on, yes. So the answer to that one is I don't know. But certainly in the towns, it was getting weaker. Okay, so let's have a look at these different movements. There are four different topics which cause people to, women in particular, to organize. These are the right to education, the right to own property when you're married, if you're a woman. These are the right to vote, of course that's the most famous one, the right to vote, but it's not the only one, the right to vote. And fourthly, the right to what we consider today to be a right, the right to birth control, the right to contraception. Okay, and if you look at these, you can see they are going to mobilize different sections of the population. First of all, if you take the first two, the right to education and the right to own property when you're married, it's fairly obvious that for the majority of the population, this is not a preoccupation. The majority of the population have no property at all anyway, so they're not going to mobilize for this. Yeah. And again, education. If you live in a family where nobody has ever had any education, then you're probably not going to be say, "Oh, women can't go to Cambridge University." That's terrible. Yeah. So it will be difficult. Today, of course, is very different. Today we have mass education, and so the right to education for women could be a very substantial movement. But at the time, these are obliged to be minority movements. They will sometimes get working class support. Sometimes, because the right to own property, even if you have only a little property, it can be quite important. But nevertheless, they will be begun by members of the elite. The right to vote will become more popular as the years go by. Of course, in 1832, if you had a campaign for the same rights for women as for men, you would be asking for the vote for a tiny minority. But after 1867, when quite a lot of workers can vote, and certainly after 1884, when the majority of workers, men, working men, can vote, then this can be a popular demand. However, the last one will be permanently popular in all classes, because the being obliged to have 12, 15, 18 children is something which is very, very extremely tiring, I'm told, and a really very, very important question. So let's take them one at once. The right to education, first of all. Well, you need to remember that a very large number of people considered that educating women was a very bad idea. A very bad idea, and all sorts of prejudices existed. Even as late as 1874, we have a document from a psychiatrist who says, "It would be an ill thing that we got the advantages of a quantity of female intellectual work at the price of a puny, enfeebled, and sickly race." And the idea behind that is that if you educate a woman, she becomes biologically inferior and will have weak, sickly children who are sick because she's not a real woman. Okay? They're very, 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 very strange to our modern eyes, prejudices, where really that because it is against the nature of women to be educated, they will become sick and degenerate if you educate them. We have had time to show that this is not necessarily true. Remember, this is a moment when women novelists Charlotte Bronte, Emily Bronte, Anne Bronte, George Eliot. How do they get their books published? They use men's names, yeah? They use men's names to get their books published, yeah? Now, it's kind of a rather strange situation because little by little, everybody knows that the Korah brothers are in fact women. Little by little, the information gets out. But they still feel this necessity to use men's names, just like the much earlier the mathematician I spoke to used a man's name. Now, the problem of education then at this time in the 1840s, in the 1850s, is more a problem for middle class women. Teaching was the only respectable profession possible for an unmarried woman of the middle classes. And very often they worked as governesses, that is to say, they worked in the house of a rich family, and they gave lessons to the children. Very often they didn't have many qualifications. They could read and write, but they didn't have many qualifications. And very often the conditions of work were very bad. But it was the best option. If you were a middle class woman, it didn't mean you were rich, but you were a middle class woman, then a governess was a good option. Otherwise, you had to stay at home and look after your parents, yeah? You couldn't leave your parents' house if you didn't have a job to go to. Or, of course, if you got married, that was the other option. And some of the socialists of the time, the radicals of the time, for example, Charles Kingsley, supported the organization of charities to help governesses, because quite often governesses, if they lost their job, for example, they had nowhere to go, and there was a lot of a certain number of poor governesses to do that. So, first thing is teaching was about the only respectable profession, but there were other things as well. Middle-class families, women and men, were often very reluctant to let their daughters be educated. Very often the family did not want their daughters educated because it would make it difficult for them to find a husband. Yeah? And this kind of reaction you can still see today. Can you, if the young women here, can you just imagine that the only thing you love in life is rugby? Okay? You can imagine your parents thinking, we'd rather you didn't become a professional rugby player because... And they're thinking, well, how will she find a man if she's a professional rugby player? You know, it's something which still exists, this kind of attitude. It's not dishonorable in itself. However, a number of schools for girls had been established. There were some schools for girls established by voluntary organizations, often political organizations. And of course, the Chartist schools, remember there were not very many of them, there were 20 or 30, yeah? The Chartist schools were an example where they said that women and men should have the same. In fact, William Lovett, the great Chartist, wrote, "Particular attention should also be devoted in Chartist schools to female education. Females ought to be taught as much knowledge as men, and in some cases more, for they are the great primary instructors of the rising race. Experimental philosophy, history, ethics, politics and religion should be soundly instilled into all young minds." Yeah, so that was, but that's very exceptional, very radical. That was the Chartist schools. This is in the early 1840s. In the early 1840s, yes, of course, Chartism. You now have this in your mind. Chartism, 1838, 1848, and a little bit more. Okay. That was the Chartists. After the Chartists, or fundamentally after the Chartists, 1847 is the first time that there were special classes for governesses. So these governesses, they had special classes in London after 1847. And in 1848, you have the establishment of Queen's College for Women. There's a Queen's College for Women. And I can imagine that the local newspapers thought this was very funny. Yeah. But that was the establishment of, and this was mostly for teaching teachers, Because there are now more and more girls' schools, although very often the girls' schools are restricted to domestic science, knitting, organizing the household, etc., the very, very restricted curriculum. The next one in 1850, Cheltenham College. These are the first colleges for women, Cheltenham College. So little by little, it was possible for girls to get primary education, although very often they had to do a lot of knitting. But it took a lot longer for universities to admit women, and it was a long struggle for women to get into universities. Remember, at this time, when you say women getting into universities, you mean women from the elite, because only people from the elite go to university. Okay. So, of course, at this time, no university would accept a woman student. But 13 years later, in fact, in 1863, Cambridge University decide an experiment. Just an experiment, and they allow women to pass the to sit the exams. Okay, remember your vocabulary, yeah? To sit an exam and to pass an exam. To sit an exam, pass an exam, and to pass an exam, to sit an exam. Don't forget that. Yeah, so in 1863, Cambridge University agreed to allow the women to sit mock exams, this exam en blanc. Huh? Not, they couldn't have a diploma or go to the classes, but they could sit these mock exams. And it was important because it was a symbol that people were thinking, well, maybe some women should be allowed to go to university. 1867, an important advance. A group of women organized open lectures in Liverpool for women. C'est un peu l'université de tous les savoirs, version 1867. They're simply public lectures by university teachers for women. So it's not going to university, but it's just lectures on university subjects for women. And the first one was on astronomy by James Stewart, a great astronomer. And 550 women came. And this was a very, very important symbol, because at the time, many people said universities for women. Women don't want universities. If you had universities for women, women wouldn't want to go. And so in Liverpool, when they said, we have a public university lecture for women, and 550 women turned up, that was a good argument for people who were saying that it's not the case. A further compromise in 1869 at Cambridge University, women are allowed to sit exams, a special exam for women. Those are the exam for the men, and then a special exam for women. Of course, it's easier because you can't expect too much of women. And this leads to a big debate, of course, inside the women's groups. You can imagine the debate. Some women say, oh, yes, this is good, a special exam for women. It's a first step. Let's go and take the exam. And other women say, no, we refuse to take an exam which is specially written for women. We want the same exam as the men. Yeah? And so a division on tactics. Yeah? Some people say, the first step will show people something. And other people say, no, it's a bad compromise. And this is the universal problem of tactics. What is an acceptable compromise in all the social movements in the 19th century, the 20th century, and the 21st century? What is an acceptable compromise? You always compromise. All social movements compromise all the time. But what is an acceptable compromise will be a big, difficult question. And in 1870, you have the establishment in Cambridge of Girton College. Now, remember, in Cambridge University, you have colleges. C'est un peu comme les résidences, mais une partie de l'enseignement se passe dans la résidence. Je ne vais pas vous expliquer tout ça. And Girton College is the first college for women, and it is still a Cambridge college today. So it was successful. And the next year, Newnham College for Women in Cambridge University was established.
What is interesting about Newnham is today it is still a college for women, because in the constitution of Newnham College it says we will have men as well when there are 50% women in Cambridge University. Yeah, and it's not yet the case, so it's still a women's college, whereas Girton is now mixed,
and that most of the Cambridge colleges are. Remember that the Cambridge University became mixed in the 1980s. The 1980s, yeah? Not the 1940s, the 1980s, they were very, very late. Yes, when I went to Cambridge University in 1980, and some of the colleges were mixed, and some of them were not mixed. Most of them were still not mixed, but they became mixed a little later on. Okay, so, these are famous things. And there's a gentleman called Sedgwick who gave the money for the college, and even if today the history library is named after him, it's become famous since. Henry Sedgwick. Sedgwick, one of them. So this is still a situation where you have two colleges for women in Cambridge University, but they cannot take the real exams. They can only take special exams for women. Okay? And in 1873, three women passed the exams, succeeded in the exams, yeah? They were officially given diplomas from Cambridge University in 1948. Okay, so they passed the exam in 1873, but of course at this time Cambridge University refused to give them a diploma. They are women. And in 1948 Cambridge gave these three women a diploma. Of course they were old ladies then, yes, but it was a symbolic thing. It was recognized. Okay, now special case of medical studies. Women wanting to be doctors and women wanting to be nurses. And the key example, again, what you're going to see is movements, campaigns by small groups of women. This is not going to be a mass movement. Elizabeth Garrett Anderson will be one of the first women to become a doctor. Today, one of the biggest hospitals in London is the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital. You will see why she deserved it. She worked as a nurse. Of course, you could be a nurse. And she went to the lectures, the doctor's lectures, the medical lectures, they called the horse, and they agreed to allow her to take the exam unofficially. To take the exam, but not have an official result, and she was number one. She got a higher mark than all the men, so they expelled her from the university. Fortunately, however, she had money. She had money, and so she continued her studies in Paris, and with the help of the Empress, l'Empress Eugénie, she had to go right to the top. She was allowed, and she got a doctorate in Paris in medicine. And she was the first English woman to get a doctorate in medicine. So that was the first example. In 1869, in Edinburgh was the next big event here. And in 1869, in Edinburgh, five women were accepted to study medicine. And at the end of the first year, one of them was number three in the year, she came third, and in theory, she should have received money from the university. Yeah, so they were officially accepted, and in theory, she should have received a grant, Mousse, but the university decided to give the money to the man who came fourth instead, and there was a big scandal, big petition, campaign, and so on. And the men students organized a petition against women coming to study medicine. Some of the men students came to the medical lectures with animals, with sheep, because they say, well, lower animals are admitted now. We allow women, why not sheep? Yeah, so you see a very violent campaign, which You must have needed a certain courage to continue going to these lectures when people are bringing sheep to handle it. So what happens? The university refuses to give the diploma to the women, and the women go to the tribunals. Yeah, they go to the courts, and the court says the university is right, so they lose in the courts, and this causes a national controversy. However, again, as I say, they're lucky, because if you're in a tiny minority, it is very, very useful to have money, and they do have money, and one of them, Sophia Jakes Blake, she founds the London School of Medicine for Women. She founds a new school, the London School of Medicine for Women, and takes a long time to move forward in that. She eventually gets recognition from the Organization of Midwives. Toutes les organisations de médecins refusent de reconnaître l'école. Mais l'organisation de sages-femmes, ils trouvent impossible de refuser. Alors ils acceptent. But the examiners of the examiners of the jury all resign instead of giving diplomas to women. They don't want to give diplomas to women, so they all resign, the entire jury of the Midwives Commission. Finally, in 1875, there is a law. And this law passes through Parliament. I haven't got the name of it here, but it doesn't matter. And this law says universities have the right to accept women. Notice, they do not have the obligation. Yeah, this law gives them the right to accept women. To study medicine. Dublin is the first to accept women, and Sophia becomes a doctor. In 1878, London University accepts that women should study medicine. However, the progress is very, very slow, and just before the First World War in 1912, there are only 500 women doctors in Britain. Yes, it's very, very slow. Although it is now possible, it's very, very slow, and by 1912 you still have only 500 women doctors. The women's colleges at Cambridge, Newnham College and Girton College, are very, very careful. They want to keep respectable opinion on their side, and so the women cannot go out without a chaperone, without somebody with them to show that, because everybody suspects that women in a Cambridge college are going to be immoral, and I can assure you it's sometimes the case. But nevertheless, at the time they wanted to be respectable, and so they every time the women went out, they had an older lady to watch them, to watch over them, and so on and so forth.
Immoral? Why?
Because women are immoral if there isn't a man next to them. This is what they thought in the 19th century. Yeah, it was just the idea was women are automatically immoral if you don't watch them carefully. Is this true? No, of course not. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that was the idea. That's the idea of the chaperone. Yeah, the chaperone. You will lose your reputation if you go out for a walk without an older lady to watch you. Well, your reputation is finished. You know? Did you have a reputation? Okay. Right. Is it too late? Oh, okay. Right.